Welcome everybody to the Rotary Club of Worldwide Impact. My name is Kelly Koo and I'll be your host today. The Rotary Club of Worldwide Impact is part of an organization called Rotary International, made up of a global network of 1.4 million neighbors, friends, leaders, and problem solvers in more than 46,000 clubs doing service above self, locally, globally, and in our case, digitally. As a Rotary Club, we approach every conversation as if we are on a shared learning journey. Our goal is to connect with and hear from fascinating and inspiring speakers, often with a message focused on the power of ideas to change lives and ultimately the world, and bring you a little inspiration that allows you to think about how you can make a difference as well. We're glad you've joined us and hope you enjoy how we explore technology in the service of others. Today, our guest connects with us from Freeport, Grand Bahama Island. Christina Zanato is an active shark behaviorist, underwater cave explorer, a champion for ocean conservation, a photographer, speaker, and writer. Christina's work can be summarized in three words: exploration, education, and conservation. As a member of the Women Divers Hall of Fame and the Explorers Club, she is a firm believer in the power of education and spends her time teaching below and above water. Christina is also the founder of the nonprofit People of the Water, organized to widen the distribution of training, education, and research related to ocean and environmental issues. We're very excited to have you on, Christina. I'll hand the mic over to you. Welcome to the Rotary Club of Worldwide Impact.
Thank you so much, Kelly, and thank you so much, Rotary Worldwide, for having me. I'm going to start with basically my presentation. I'm going to start by sharing my screen. Let me go straight into that. And I picked this one is basically a summarize of what has been 28 years of my life. So I'm going to try to, I usually say it's 28 minutes for 28 years. So 1 minute per year that I've spent into this life, which is a mix of sharks and caves. And I started my journey back in 1994 when I traveled to Freeport, Grand Bahama, where then I decided to stay to learn how to scuba dive. And the moment I learned how to scuba dive, which was a childhood dream, I immediately fell in love with it and I decided I would stay. And one of the reasons is they actually had a gentleman called Ben Rose that had started working with sharks. And I wanted to be an underwater scuba ranger that could actually work with sharks. And actually my real dream was to swim around the ocean without my mom telling me that I had to come out of the water because my lips were purple, and telling people what to do and what not to do. And I would have this score of sharks following me because I had sharks for friends. And so into this twist of event, which I usually now tell people, I said, you should do it. If you're 22 and you have a dream of doing something, go and try it out. Don't wait. If it doesn't work out, you can always backtrack and do something else. So I did exactly that. In 1 week, I went back home and I quit my job, told my boyfriend I will be back in a year. I hope he's still not waiting. Packed all my stuff and actually moved to Freeport, Grand Bahama. My intention was to stay here for a year and dive and work in the hotel industry, which was my background. I speak five languages. And then one thing led to another, and here we are about 28 years later. I am an advanced cave diving instructor, rebreather instructor trainer, shark behaviorist. And basically what I did is I grew both vertically in titles, in obviously experience in personal education, but also grew horizontally. So I started looking into anything that was related to the field that I was so in love with. So first I came here and I really love sharks, but then shark survival depends on so many things, some of which I'm going to touch during this presentation. So I start talking to this scientist that is specialized in conch, and then I start talking to this scientist that is specialized in hydrology, and it's like, well, how does conch and hydrology relate with sharks? And so I broaden my view and vision, because I realized I was actually in two fields, cave diving and sharks. So when I mentioned them to people, they usually go, oh no, oh, well, I'm claustrophobic and I'll never swim with any kind of sharks in my life. Never mind, I have pit bulls at home. So that usually brings up the third window that they close when I talk to them. So I find myself loving something so much and a lot of windows closed. And so my idea was like, okay, I'm gonna bring my love for this to you. To do this, I found different methods. So some I agree with, some I disagree with, but they work really, really well. And is in the end, I really believe in what Baba Dhyan said, you know, you protect what you love. And so that's where my work comes from. So I'm a professional diver. So let me take you back to third grade when you learn the water cycle. Not to learn all of it, but usually we learn this and then somehow we kind of like forget it, or we do remember that evaporation and humidity turns into rain and snow, collects somewhere and runs off into rivers and into the ocean, and somewhat is related. And this is very, very important because, like I said, we have it, it's there, but then sometimes, a lot of times we forget it. To put together what I do, I'm going to start with my work with sharks. These are my, literally my girls. This is the shiver of Caribbean reef sharks. And this is a picture taken the moment I enter the water. So I enter the water and all the sharks basically start swimming towards me. I had my camera kind of like down and I basically snapped this shot because this is part of the work I do and part of my office. To most people, this is how my sharks look. Is a bundle of gray bodies that basically swirl around and swirl. But to me, this is how my sharks look. They have names, they're easily recognizable, they have personalities, they have a presence, they have different behaviors. Now, if you look at the names, hook, half-baked, stumpy, scrunchy, crook, you'll notice they're not very, pleasant names. You know, I didn't call them beautiful names like Kelly or Stephanie or Julie. And the reason why is I wanted people to connect with them immediately. So the name is associated with a very identifiable physical characteristic. For example, Hook has the dorsal fin, at the bottom of the dorsal fin is slightly shaped like a hook. And so when somebody sees Hook swimming around, I give the hook signal. And I give them my finger like this, and they actually see immediately a hook. Stumpy has a little piece of her tail missing. So when I show Stumpy, I tell them, this is Stumpy, she's missing a piece of the tail. So immediately somebody can connect the animal to a name. And once we connect an animal to a name, we identify a creature, a living, breathing, thinking creature, where before it was just a mass of gray bodies, which triggers, I will never swim with any shark. But then I have the people that go, oh, how is grandma doing? How is a stumpy doing? How is this shark doing? And that's the first step. Let's connect people to these animals in maybe a little bit of an anthropomorphic way, which I try to stay away from. But at the same time is we got to give them something that is beyond that mindless, swimming body, jaws at the end of nerve ending, all these comments that I receive from people. So what do we do with these sharks? Well, we dive with them and we bring people to dive with them. We interact with them, but we also collect data. So one of the things we do is we go down, this is grandma, and during the dives, every few months, not all the time, we take videos. Grandma swimming one side, grandma swimming the other side. And now we have a whole view of grandma. How is she looking? And then how is she looking in 6 months? Because their shape and size changes. Sometimes they're pregnant. Sometimes they lose some weight. Sometimes they have navy marks. So we keep this record of these animals all throughout their lifestyle. And then we do physical pictures. So this is grandma again, but this is a close-up picture. Grandma is recognizable from a blemish in her left eye. So instead of being completely intact, the pupil is a little bit dilated. And then she has also, believe it or not, a little periodontitis on the lower jaw. So she has a little bit of a mashed up tissue. And so she's recognizable because she's always swimming around with what looks black. If you take a picture, it's a little bit inflamed, it's like red, it's like an inflamed quote unquote gum. So grandma is actually one of the easiest ones to recognize. And her name comes from the fact that she's super light in their gray. Some sharks are super dark. She's light in the gray. So the hair of grandma, she's a very gentle predisposition in nature. And that's how her name came about. So that's what we do. This is, for example, is Peggy. Peggy is missing a little sliver from her left pectoral fin, if you look there. So Peggy, that's her name. So it's easy again to recognize that this is a black spot. Black spot comes from Gilligan Island, the pirates, and the eye patch. And, you know, we're in the Bahamas. So he has a blemish in his eye that completely blackened out his eye. So instead of having the cat eye that Caribbean ray sharks has, it's completely black. And so we call him black spot because he's easy to recognize because when you show up, he looks like he's wearing a pirate's patch. So all the names are quickly identifiable with the animals. Now he's a he, you can't see in these pictures, but he sports a pair of claspers. So sharks are actually very easy to recognize sex-wise. A difference from most of the fish out in the ocean where you can recognize a lot of them also change sex through their lifetime. Sharks are born out of females or males and they're very identifiable as they swim by, the sports external organs like we do. Things that we do with the sharks, we have been collecting DNA through the years. So I have this capability of putting sharks to sleep. And so the students can come in and collect DNA as the sharks is laying in my lab. Trying to find the relationship, their closest cousins. The next project we're involved with is trying to find actually if we have a relationship between the generations that have been coming through. I've been here 28 years and Caribbean ray sharks live between 15 and 18. We are going through a third change, a guard change, I call it. So we have new girls coming in, about 5 to 6 so far recorded. So are these related to the girls that were here before? So that's one of the things we're doing. And then the other one that we do is, this is a lot of fun. We do shark photogrammetry. We use laser, very non-invasive, after we swim by, we have a GoPro. These are two laser beams, measure the sharks while we are taking the video. Then we come home and we screenshot, crop the photo and keep an update on how much they grow. And growth rate for Caribbean reef sharks is very important because that's how they reproduce. So some sharks reproduce due on age, the Caribbean reef sharks reproduce due on size. Which brings in other issues. Are they eating enough? If they're not eating, then they're not growing. Can they actually reproduce? How long does it take for this new shark that just showed up on the dive that is 3 foot to actually go into our first mating season? We have girls that started mating the first time this summer, after 4 years of being present on the site and slowly growing. So all this little information is primarily citizen science we do during the dive. But we're also working and interacting with the sharks. That's what we're doing. Comes with that is what I've been starting to do. So as I start working with sharks, there's a lot of anthropogenic influences that these animals go through. And one of the most evident, maybe the least interfering of them, but the most evident to the eyes of people is the presence of hooks from fishers. Now, these are accidental catches, so sometimes they might be intentional. Those sharks are protected in the Bahamas. But what I start seeing is the discomfort that these animals have and some of the damages. And so what I started doing is basically I started to remove hooks from sharks. I wear a stainless steel suit. I do believe that protecting myself means protecting the sharks. When I work with them and nothing happens to me, then nothing will turn around and happen to them, right? If I'm a chef and I work in the kitchen, I wanna wear a mitten when I pull my pots out of the oven. It's the same concept. There's a bee suit, the same way I'm gonna go and work with these. When I work with sharks in a regular way, like I go swim with them, but I don't interfere at this level, I don't need the suit. But as you can see, I'm kind of like sliding my arms down their throat to remove a hook that was in our throat. This is foggy eye. So I start removing these hooks and I start doing it the same way I would remove a thorn out of my dog paw. My dog comes out of the bush, has a thorn in the paw, is like, oh, my poor puppy, remove the thorn. But the same as the dogs I first started adopting dogs, and all of a sudden I started realizing how many dogs there was on the side of the road, and we started rescuing dogs. As I started removing hooks from the sharks that I worked with, this was one dive I removed all those hooks from different sharks. So quite a lot of presence. This definitely was one of those times where I feel some people were trying to just fish the sharks in order to take pictures and say, hey, look at me, I fished the shark, and then maybe release the shark. That's where that neither comes to the conversation. So once I start removing these hooks, all I was trying to tell people is, listen, I love sharks. I don't say sharks love me. I cannot give sharks interpretations of emotions. That's not my place. But I love sharks and I want to protect them. What I didn't realize is that these hooks will become the ambassadors for not only these sharks, but a lot of sharks in the world. I start having people saying, I never thought sharks could feel pain. How many of us grew up with relatives, parents telling us that fish does not feel pain? I'm a Mediterranean girl, I'm Italian. I grew up in a family that told me fish doesn't feel pain. I'm like, yes, they do. I watched the sharks slamming into the sand when they have a hook. I watched them shaking their pectoral fin just like really bother. I watched them refusing to eat because of a hook in their mouth. So I start collecting these hooks. And these hooks became the collective ambassadorship for sharks world. People start asking me, I need to help sharks. I need to come there and help you remove hooks. And I'm like, no. No, please don't do that. It takes a little bit of time, a little bit of skills, a little bit of repetition. What you can do is work to help sharks where you are. And that's what I did. In 2009, I started a petition to start protecting sharks in the Bahamas. This is where I live and work. My voice was heard. And the Bahama National Trust and a few organizations picked up this petition. And then on 5th of July, 2011, the Bahamas declared 248,000 square miles of our archipelago a shark sanctuary. So where you are, where your voice matters, this is where you can start helping sharks. And you can do that through a lot of things. And I do a lot of education on my social media. Start thinking about changing the ways you live, the way you eat. Small changes at the time, you don't need to do drastic changes all on one time. But what it happened is you really triggered into people the notion that sharks are living, breathing, sentient creatures. And so change that. So I change it. One diver at the time, one day at the time, one visitor at the time. I create these ambassadors that come from parts of the world. Or I speak five, you know, there's thousands and thousands of languages in the world. So I have people coming from all over the world. And then they go back to their country and they speak all these languages, Indonesian, Farsi, Czech Republic, Russian, and they share this in their world, in their languages, in their culture, in a way that I could never do, because at the end of the day, I'm a Western white girl. But they have a way to go into their culture with their language and being able to transfer in a way that is more listenable to. Because I do believe that we need to communicate rather than yelling and screaming. So that's one of the things I do. I take people on these therapeutic experiences, then allow me to actually host hordes of young people, usually aspiring ecologists, biologists, environmentalists, and I host them for free for 2 to 3 weeks. And they stay with me and they learn the ways of how do we transform a shark business into a shark conservation? What is the small actions that we can do every day, but from picking up trash? Why caves are related with sharks, which you're about to learn. And so the paid work that I do then pays for hosting these kids. And that's where I start actually founded a nonprofit to allow me to host more of these, to expand the local education. I educate a lot of the local people, primarily into the art of scuba diving as a trade. Become a dive master, become an instructor, become a shark a diver, because you can actually use the same shiver of sharks day in, day out for the rest of your life. And it will continuously make you money, running if you go out and fish one. and kill it. So this is part of my Bahamian kids. Most of them, these are all pictures of like Bahamian kids have been involved with me in the work that I do. I outsource only local boats, local captains, local dive masters, and they continuously stay into this business. So that's how shark conservation works for me, is you give them a value and you give this value to someone else to appreciate, and then you expand that. So these are some of the outreach programs that I do. We do swimming programs, teaching in school, picking up garbage, training dive masters and instructors. Thank you, technology. I do a lot of online outreach programs like this one. Thank you again, Rotary World International. I think I do an average is about 100 a year. Plus I do a lot of mentorships online. I have young people that reach out to me, so I'll do Zoom calls and mentorships and talks. And then luckily now that started again after COVID, I also am invited to go and speak at conferences. So I end up going and speak about sharks, cave conservation, how it all related. When I am invited, I also go in places. This was from Singapore. I'm Finnish with Finns, but I do believe in the concept of being invited, not barging my way in. So when the people from a certain country invite me in and say, "Hey, come, we would like for you to enforce our message," and then I gladly go. This was one of my favorite time. This campaign in Finnish with Finns. So how do sharks relate to the other work? It's a unique link, provided that my love for sharks and caves was parallel. I love both. I absolutely am as much into sharks as much as into cave exploration, teaching cave diving. And so one day I was standing in ankle deep water and I was preparing my cave diving gear to go exploring this part of a key, and this tiny little shark swam by my ankles. And although I knew the sharks lived in the mangroves, and I knew that sharks and mangroves and blue holes and mangroves, all of a sudden it was just like, I'm about to go into this blue hole and here's a shark. So here is the connection between caves and sharks. A lot of caves in the Bahamas are called blue holes, and they actually come out into the mangroves. Mangroves in this part of the world, like many other parts of the world, you can say kelp forests in other part of the world, are lively nursery grounds. They protect land, they protect small fish. They are the places where spores grow. They're the places where the corals are protected. So they're like this very vital location. This is a place where a lot of species of sharks also leave their babies, because sharks have no parental care. So they leave the babies into these mangroves. And in the Bahamas, we have two types of caves. We have land-based caves. In general, by the culture, they're called blue holes. The blue holes traditional more just in the ocean. So these are land-based caves where we have a freshwater lens on top of a saltwater lens. And similar to, a lot of people compare it to the cenotes in Mexico, it's a similar ground composition, so it's a similar systems underwater, underground. And then we have what we call ocean blue holes. This is an opening in about 300 yards, 300 meters shore, and it goes straight down to 40 feet, about 12 meters, and then through a little fissures, it goes into like a massive cave system. And these are tidal dependent. And then what they do is move water. In the freshwater lens, we float into this incredible world that is completely, you know, clear. This is actually my husband, Kevin, is coming down from the upper level of a cave in Granada. Now, the presence of these decorations, called in this case, stalagmites, shows that these caves were once dry. And I could give a whole presentation about caves and what happened in the Bahamas, but like between glacier and interglacier period, this cave went through three rising and falling of sea levels between 20 feet higher, 6 meters higher than we are now. Hopefully we're not going back there, up to 420 feet, 130 meters lower than where we are now. So imagine the Bahamas, where these Dover Sound cliffs hanging over the Caribbean Ocean. Some of the holes, when we're going into them, present of mix. So right now we're going into basically a saltwater blue hole. And then while we're in there, we float up into upper level of fresh water where we find these decorations, again, a symbol of the fact that these caves were dry. This is actually a Sweden ski. And then we have a mix of these tunnels that were dissolved by the water. And so these caves, what they do is they present quite a lot of information. The first one for me, the most important is fresh water sits on top of salt water. Where you see the black line, this is completely underwater picture. Where you see the black line, that's the salt water. Where you see all the white level, that's the fresh water. The reason why is in the halocline, the transition between the two medias, there's a little bacteria that produces that waste product that then deposits and creates all the black stuff. And so we have fresh sitting on top of salt. If you guys are not familiar with the Bahamas, we are a land of flatness. Our highest point is 200 feet above sea level. Mount Alvernia is 61 meters above sea level. We have no rivers, no lakes, no glaciers, no snow. But when it rains, the water filters through these magnificent limestones into the caves and deposits there for people to use. Before Hurricane Dorian, we had fresh drinking water out of the tub that came from the ground. So one value to the caves. What does it have to do with sharks? We'll get in there. So in 2012, I did something that I was told you could not do. Never say that, because then I say, watch me. So what I did, I swam from a land-based cave, one of those that you saw, that I showed you the pictures, all the way to the ocean, that fissure that you saw into. And basically, I physically connected a land cave to an ocean blue hole, never done in history before. We had caves that went into mangroves, but we never had someone that swam from land, submerged, see you later, and showed up on the beach and then waded from the beach back to shore. And that's what I did in 2012. These caves, like I said, transfer water. 6 hours twice per day, they do what we call siphon. So they suck ocean water into them. This is due into intertidal changes due to Little Bahama Bank. I'm not gonna sit here, it's quite a long. But what they do is they siphon the water in. And as they siphon the water in, they siphon in anything that is traveling through the ocean. Like in this case, plastic. Don't worry, I didn't let it go because I was like, should I let it go? And I was just like, I can't, I have to take it out. But when they don't siphon, they actually blow water. And so from the inland, they blow water out 6 hours per day, twice per day with a little break. And what they do is everything that has been siphoned in, but also everything that is being transferred from the terrain through the limestone into the cave, they will blow it out. This is a cave in the ocean, Ocean Blue Hole, that my husband and I were exploring, were mapping, and that's my exploration reel. The plastic was further than I can physically reach. And funny enough, in a 2-hour dive, we put the line down. When we were coming out, there was already plastic wrapped around this brand new line that we just put down. That actually was a puncture from the cruise ship. I have no idea how it made it there. So what we do is basically we see stuff going in and we know that there's stuff going out. What does it do? This is a cave that is protected now, that I worked on between 2009 and 2011, and took about 10 years, but actually it's completely protected. And you're looking at water. This is submerged. Look at the clarity of this water. What you see orange there is a microbial growth. It's an animal. It's a very unique animal, but they basically thrive into this environment. And this is a healthy cave. You see it from the balance and the beauty of it. This is the cave that I connected from the land to the ocean under a settlement. an unregulated location where sewage pipes and garbage is thrown into the hole and things go through the limestone, because the limestone is very porous as well, and hits the water. That's the same microbial growth, but like anything, algae, think about algae, right? Algae blooms are caused by nitrates that we throw into the ocean, especially from agriculture. Here it is. So this water table is literally shut. This water is unapproachable. It smells. Usually when I come out completely covered in an orange sheen. I usually try to dive in it in a dry suit so it doesn't reach, but it still reaches my face and my ears. But there's no more fresh water here. And imagine now, I swam from land to open ocean, from open ocean to land. Well, if a physical body, I'm 5'5", 125 pounds, with all the tanks and the gear, if I can make it through, so can little tiny chemicals that actually dissolve in the water. That could be E. coli, that could be mercury, that could be anything that you can think of. So what these blue holes have is, look at that, is life around them. And they actually bring a lot of nutrients. They collect these sharks around them, they collect corals. So what to do? One of the jobs that we do on the side, so we train people in technical diving, okay? And then on the side, on our time off, we go diving. And what we do is we line these caves and then we map them. This is one of the modern system, Lestat system. And it's a very new little super affordable system that we like to use. And we map the caves and then we collect all this data and give it to the Bahama National Trust. The hardest part with caves is they're literally out of sight, out of mind. So what we say is like, hey, look, the yellow star, that's the entrance of the cave, right? And people always focus on the entrance, but the blue line tells you where the cave goes. And so all of a sudden, if you were to develop something on that beach, you will be affecting the cave, you will be affecting the underground, and you will be affecting the school of fish that you saw at the beginning of the video. And with it, you will be affecting the mangroves. This is a rich mangrove area where this blue hole is. You will be affecting then the sharks and the corals and sea urchins and. And so that is where it's important to connect caves and sharks, is they have this full connection. How do you make people fall in love with wet rocks? I mean, with sharks, it's kind of okay. You know, I give it a pat, a little bit of cattle, give it a kiss, I remove a hook. They kind of like, you know, breathe, move around. It's easier to have people fall in love, you know, with toothy creatures. But wet rocks, oof, that's a little bit harder. So one of the things that we do is we bring up what we see. So I invested in this ginormous camera and video lights, and it's all self-financed. And we swim down the tunnels. And we literally swim down the tunnels following the line. And with the camera, we take video of the cave and all the tunnels that were down there. And when we take these videos, we then bring them into the map. So we do the map, we take the videos. And now we're about to launch our first one down on the Bahama National Trust. I can give you a tablet. I can give you a video. You can say, where am I? And you can click on the map. And if you see this big round circle, the bigger one is traveling along. All the other one are little marks. We're actually going to do it's going to have less. But those are all stations that you can follow. And so now you're swimming with me on the ground in the cave, exactly where I was. And it's going to stop right. You see that, how it stops right where the crossways of the line on the map is? It stops right on the crossway of the lines into right here. This is a crossway. These are the lines of the cave. And then here, that's where the, if you look at it again, the big circle is moving and is actually following and going along the cave. And so we take this camera everywhere and we film. If you notice, some of the tunnels don't have yellow dots. The reason why is maybe it's too small to go with the main camera. We haven't done yet. But the intent is to say, look, this is underneath your feet. It's not just a pine tree or a palmetto next to you. This is what's underneath your feet. This is what you're about to dig through. This is what you're about to build over. And so give value on what's underneath and hopefully bring up also beauty. we have phenomenal pictures with crystals and all that. And then the other thing is we also monitor, thanks to another professor, Dr. Patricia Bedos, we monitor water flow in the caves. We put in these meters, again, very much homemade. A lot of the technology we use, we like the fact that it has access that is fairly affordable for the average person. It's not a $40,000 NOAA system. It's a $250 home built with PVC pipes system. It's incredible. And so these flow meters monitor the movement. Where does the tide go? Which way? What time of day? What was the depth? What was the salinity? Unfortunately, we didn't have these in when Dorian hit this island. Oh, most likely Dorian would have ripped them off, but it would have been interesting to maybe retrieve them and see really what changed. Because we noticed about a 10 meters depth change in the water caves during Dorian due to the hydrological pressure of the water that came over the island. So where does this translate? This is one of the example. This is Bent's Cave, very dear to my heart. That's where it's our cavern and cave diving, named after my mentor, Ben Rose, who's no longer with us. And the park, the original park was the red line. But after we mapped and did all the interactive map and expanded the caves, actually we expanded by another 6,000 feet, so about a mile, so a kilometer and a half. We proposed it to the Bahama National Trust, which actually brings it to the government. And so the yellow rectangular is now the new protected area. So expanded considerably. And now we're trying to push our luck and expand a little bit more into the blue one, one step at a time. So that's how we work. We bring up the data, we give it, we try to connect, we bring up the beauty. We just finished submitting a full description of Bent's Cave with all the pictures that we collected to the BNT for their new visitor centers. So the people that go there, instead of just looking at the little puddle of water, they go, wow, this is underneath my feet. And this is definitely worth saving. And with that, we're doing that all over the island. So we've been, what we do on our days off, we start hiking and moving our way through the island. We identify places that, thanks to Google Earth, and then we hike there. The red stars are places we have verified that showed a presence of a cave, but we cannot physically get in because maybe a collapse is pinched, all sorts. The yellow ones is verified mapped caves, and the purple ones is as a potential, we need to go and verify it. This is a little bit of an old map. We have another dozen stars on this map right now. So just to very active. And this is one island. So the concept is for us is think globally, work locally. So everything that I've been doing in Grand Bahama Island then has to transfer. That's how I ended up in Hong Kong. That's how I ended up in Singapore. That's how I ended up maybe hopefully talking here about this. And this is quote by which I live, by which really makes perfect sense. And in the end, we will conserve only what we love. We will only what we understand, and we'll understand only what we are taught. Exploration, education, conservation, we have to explore the known and the unknown. Sometimes we have to question the known. So we're explorers at heart. We need to follow that exploration. The education part, we have to educate ourselves so that we educate others. That's where I connect with a lot of professors. I am no professor, I'm a diver. I am the robotic pinchers of a giant robot with like 600 brains. I relate to professors that study shark vision, shark pregnancies, shark movements. I relate to professors that study hydrology and geology and environment. And I just siphon everything from that. So I had to educate myself, and I transformed this into very basic education for regular people that maybe are not interested in reading the papers. So I read the papers, then I go, oh, here's my social media blurb. And then conservation. Once you make people fall in love with toothy animals and wet rocks, then they will be with you on the sidelines wanting to protect them. And that is where the conservation I talk about, you capture more bees with honey than with vinegar. That's when I say, talk to your people. Don't scream and yell. Use your language, use your culture to reach out to people. So so that you can actually help. Because I do believe that one small action is better than no big action. And each one of us can make a difference. I leave you with my two websites. ChristinaZanato.com is where my work is concentrated, and the POW nonprofit is where our exploration, education, conservation work is. The two of them very much blend. If you told me where's the boundaries, I don't know. I start at 5 a.m., I finish at 8 p.m. is a mix of work, diving, education, and all of that in one.
Thank you, Christina. Well, it's great to hear more about your career, all the work you've done, and to see how it's taken you in really different directions. But at the end of the day, everything is interconnected. The stories and footage you've shared are truly captivating.
Thank you.
Given the sheer number of dives that you've done, I'd be really curious to hear about your unique insights as to how the ocean environment around you and the marine life around you has changed over time. Have you seen any trends?
Yes. So one of the things that I have to my advantage is what I call dive site fidelity. I'm very much a creature of habit, and I don't mind diving the same site 10,000 times. I think each time presents something new. So I've seen different waves. The first wave when I came here, the Bahamas were coming out of a death of the long spine sea urchins. And unfortunately with that came a wave of algae covering the reef. And then, but the fish was pretty active. And then I saw a wave where the sea urchins now are making a comeback, and the algae somewhere is a little bit reduced. And although there's a new epidemic now for sea urchins that is coming up from the Southern Caribbean, hopefully it's not gonna make it here because of the current. But what happens is I saw a reduction in fish in general, and I saw the death of stony corals. Stony corals are taking a beating. I call it, it's being called the hidden pandemic. One of the biggest ones is this stony coral tissue loss disease. It's a mouthful. Is a disease that can kill a 300-year coral head in 2 to 3 weeks. You can physically go down there and see fizzling it away. There's all sorts of diseases. There's the wide band disease, the black band disease, there's bleaching, but this one is brutal. It obliterated a coral head on the shark side in 3 weeks. I watch it getting sick. And there's no, right now they're trying to do like antibiotic treatment, maybe chipping away and then putting some antibiotic right at the edge. But if it jumps over, it jumps over. So it's different than necrotic tissues. You know, necrotic tissues, if you think about it, you could actually cut off a limb and then the necrotic tissue stops. But this one can actually, because of spores, it can actually jump over. It is heartbreaking. Some of the stuff is completely, I know coral head by coral head. You can plop in the middle of the stretch that I dive, and I will tell you which dive site is which. I can find the pin for a mooring in the middle of giant coral heads. So I actually know the coral heads, and I see them. Like the other day, I went to visit one, and she's gone. So it was just like heartbreaking. So there's definitely changes. There's some of it. Is it natural? Is it human-induced? So some of it, they say it's human-induced, but it's definitely sweeping fast through our oceans.
Are there any, I mean, these sound like dire consequences. Are there any positive changes that you've noticed over time?
One of the positives we have in the Bahamas is we still have very healthy population of sharks. And the shark, where the sharks are, there's a healthy population of fish. And where there's a healthy population of fish, we have coral heads without algae. So it's very much the protection of sharks is 10 years old. We have little factions that says, you know, there's too many sharks. The population is exploding. I'm like, we don't have the numbers and population of sharks. Predators is really funny to me in general, predators. And again, I'm not, like I said, I'm not a marine biologist, but observations, predators are designed not to explode. We can have zoo animals, we can have herbivores exploding on land and underwater. But if you think about it, there's never been an explosion of wolves. There's never been an explosion of lions. There's been an explosion of rabbits. There's been an explosion of kangaroos, but there's never been an explosion of our predators because they're designed by nature to keep their numbers low. They're traditionally reproduced on small offsprings very late, like very, very guarded, and so on. So sharks, the sharks, where there are sharks, there's a healthy environment. And I've seen that in the Bahamas as well as I've seen that in Fiji. Fiji has another beautiful system. I was there for several weeks. I lived in one of the villages that was hosted by people there. And they have the villages taking care of one part of the ocean and they completely protect them. They do the shark dives in there and all the villagers are involved into the dive operation. They only hire locals into dive operation. And then next to it, the villagers can fish. And all of a sudden the protected area is doing well and the fish spills over. And so the villagers turn around and it's like, oh wow, if you protect here, it actually, there's more fish to fish. And it's just that concept that people sometimes think, you know, like I'm against fishing. I'm not against fishing. I'm against the constant taking, the global, you know, the industrial fishing, the constant demand and not instead understanding seasons, going back to more natural ways, more of a balance between taking and as consumers sometimes saying, you know what, this is not the season, I'm not going to expect it in the supermarket or at the market, and it's okay. But I live in a fishing community, participated with Dr. Megan Davis, she's doing repopulation of conch, and for us it's heartbreaking, right? It's just like we don't consume animals, but we are dealing with fishers who rely on conch fishing, but we're teaching them, she's teaching them, I was just participating and learning, I do apologize for saying we, I'm not. She's teaching them, take care of your conch, look how long it takes for your conch to grow, so then you understand how to fish it better. And it's just absolutely fascinating. So yeah, there are positive changes as well.
It's good to hear. Yeah, it's good to hear from both sides. So with that said, let's move on officially to the question and answer period. We do have some questions that have been coming through. So I would love to have Arena ask her question.
You said earlier that you don't want to ascribe feelings to the sharks, but do you feel like they recognize you and you have some sort of bond with them?
Yes, I do believe they do recognize us and they recognize me. I've had people saying that when I hit the water, the sharks have an attraction to me that they don't have to others. I actually had instances where I had someone shoulder to shoulder with me and I teach them to reach out and try to pet the sharks on the head and the sharks will literally veer away. They will not allow this person because maybe they're very nervous and they'll keep coming towards me and we'll literally attach shoulder to shoulder. So they have a recognition. Sometimes as humans, we think, oh, well, how can they recognize you under the mask and all of that? And it's like, how can my dogs recognize my steps up the stairs and the one by next door neighbor and they don't bark? But when the handyman comes up the stairs to repair my next door neighbor's air conditioner, they bark. And so it's the same thing. Sharks has a keen sense of smell. We humans work on smell. So I imagine when I hit the water, they do smell me. There's a something exuding from my skin that gives them an indication of who I am or who you are. So yes, they definitely do recognize. They have different personalities. Some sharks are very shy. Some sharks are very bossy in a certain way. Some sharks learn really fast. So some sharks take a little bit to learn, like my dogs. I have one dog, love them dearly, but he's slightly, it takes a lot of training. Some sharks are dominant. Some sharks are not. Some sharks come in and they immediately catch on what we're doing. And some sharks will circle around us for weeks at a time before they take the courage to come in.
And how do they feel about the removing of the hooks? Do they like approach you like, hey, please, can you take this out? Or
yes. So that's the interesting part. So they do come in with the hook If it's really fresh, I'd notice as soon as I look at her and I look at the hook, she'll be like, no, you don't touch, almost as if they know that I'm thinking about removing the hook. When they come in and the approach close enough, when I start removing the hooks, they obviously stay there for a few seconds and then swim away, because no animal will sit there through pain. Even my dog will come out with a paw and go, oh, I have a thorn. And when I go to grab the thorn, they're like, it's going to hurt. So they do the same. The sharks will swim away. But the interesting part, the beautiful part, is they'll do a loop around and come back in. And loop around and come back in. And I even have sharks that sometimes almost pause. They put their tail in the sand and I was like, okay, I'm going to try. And then they take off and come back in. And then furthermore, I have sharks. When I start removing hooks, there's a different energy in the water than when I'm interacting with them. It's a little bit more heightened energy. Obviously, it's more like confusing because there's pain involved. But then other sharks that I never seen before will start showing up with hooks. And some of them have shown up. I have removed the hooks and then they left and I never seen them again. Black patch is a perfect example. He only shows up on the dive when he has a hook. When he does, then I remove the hook, then he's gone. And then he comes back next time with a hook. I don't know if it has something to do with being a male.
So he knows, hey, I need to go to the hook removal place. And
it seems so, yes. It seems that there, am I a cleaning station? Am I a good cleaning station? Maybe, but there's definitely a connection between my presence and coming with hooks. And transferring that knowledge to other sharks. We had a shark that came in,
word of mouth.
Never seen it before. Yeah, never seen it before, didn't recognize it, went through our catalogs, didn't know who she was, and came in and came straight into my stomach floor and laid in my lap and allowed me to pet her.
So, that's awesome.
Yeah, as a follow-up question, so do you find that the shark's behavior towards you changes like after the hook removal? Does it create this, does this act of kindness create this strong bond?
For some, it did. The one that you saw where I shoved my hand down her throat, she's no longer with us. That was Foggy Eye. And she was one of the sharks that will come in during the dive and I could pet her like on the head, but she kept swimming away. And then after the hook removal, she will just come in and lean on me. Traditional sharks, when they stop swimming, they sink. But opposite of popular beliefs, most of the sharks have a system called buccal pumping. They can actually inhale water and when they squeeze it through their gills, extract oxygen. So they can actually sit motionless and pump water over their gills by a mouth movement. And so Foggy Eye, all of a sudden, she'd be like, I'd be like down there standing, looking this way, and I will feel pressure on my leg and I will be looking down. I'd be like, Foggy Eye, say hi. And so that was the most drastic change in behavior that I ever seen in a shark. She went from like, yeah, you can pet me as I swim by, but I don't wanna lay in your lap, to like literally leaning into me at any chance she had. Is it coincidence? Is it anthropomorphic? I don't know, but it was like, that was like one of those crazy ones. And so it's the same with other ones. I had a new shark that showed up with the hook in her pectoral fin, and I removed it. It's like 2-3 weeks ago. And as I did it, she flipped over and almost went slightly in tonic. But I almost really paused. And when I removed this huge hook out of her pectoral fins, now she's on the dive. Like, hey, hi, I'm back. Remember me? So we have a new shark called Floppy on the dive, because her tail in the back is a little bit, instead of being like nice and straight, it's just a little bit. So we have Floppy on the dive. And it was right after the hook removal. Showed up. I only seen it once before. Showed up with the hook, came straight in with the hook, removed the hook, and now she's permanent on the dive.
And this is telling all their friends.
Yeah, but that's comparing behaviors, right? Usually when a new shark shows up on the area, it takes about 5-6 months for it to become comfortable with the interaction. And this girl showed up once. We saw her before. I'm like, oh, look at that shark. She's new. And then she just disappeared. Then I saw her another times. And the third time she came like beeline towards me, whoa, with the hook in her pectoral fin. And now she's just there. There is definitely a correlation. I do believe there is a correlation.
Now we have another question from the audience. What is your most memorable marine life encounter?
Where do I start? I would say the first and every time that one of these sharks comes into my lap. The first time was Ben Rose was there and he was watching me, and it was just like kind of like the approval of Yoda, Master Yoda. And the weight of the sharks, that when she comes in, she's a little bit tense, and then slowly it's just like, and you feel this weight increasing into your lap. They're taller, relaxing. They're completely awake. They're not in tonic immobility. They're very awake. If you move your finger on their eye follows your finger. If you move too sudden, they'll be like, oh. Sometimes when I have a shark asleep, if my student comes in and they're a little bit nervous, they'll be like, I don't think I want you to touch me. They're literally like moving more into my side. So they're very awake. And so there's this concept of trust. In this moment, I'm comfortable and I trust you to be completely vulnerable, because I'm laying here in your lap while all the other sharks swim around. So that is one of my most memorable. I think the other one is the birth of an octopus. Oh, I had this octopus with eggs on a coral head. This is where dive site fidelity comes in. And I found her and she had the eggs and she was always protecting it. Unfortunately, I don't know if you know, but octopus females, they tend to their eggs to their detriment, to their death. So they'll refuse to go out and eat. And once the eggs are hatched, then the octopus females dies. So it's kind of, it's nature. But so I kept watching her. And then think about this, right? Of all the hours you can be in the ocean. I was on a night dive and I was like, oh, I wonder how the octopus is doing. And so I kind of like swam by the hole. And as I got to by the hole, it was like all this fuzzy stuff. I'm like, what's going on? It was like really, and I looked and she was pumping out all her hatchlings. So tiny, tiny little octopi hatchlings by the hundreds of thousands. I just like, this is, so I backed away. And then a month later, I was on the same side on a night dive and I found a tiny little octopus about this big running in the sand. And I'm like, I know you, I'm your auntie. So those are, you know, in all the hours of the day that an octopus can hatch eggs, it was just like that one moment on that one dive to be witnessing her pumping all these hatchlings out after me was mind blowing.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. Another question from the audience. What's your advice for future oceanographers and explorers who want to gain experience in this field?
My goodness. Do you have another hour? So depends what you want to do, but if you're interested into the field, you need to understand that the field requires to be by the field. So I have a lot of people say, oh, I live in Colorado, I want to work with sharks. It's kind of like, you have to move where the sharks are. All that is gold, all that glitters is not gold. So they are price to pay for you to make these choices. My best suggestion is learn horizontally and not just go vertically. So don't go from title to title to title, but try to learn also, like I said, field work. Go on something. What does conch have to do with sharks? A lot. Just being on the boats with these fishers, being in the mangroves with them, watching them, knowing their conch, gave me a different view on something else that then can apply to everything. So seek opportunity that are hands-on with the capability of expanding your knowledge just horizontally. Understand that it will require some grit, and showing up is not enough. Showing up, it's easy. It's a stain that has that requires the dedication. If you want to be in a research field, remember for every week that you research in the field, there's a 3 months you spend in the lab. And if you want to be in a field like mine, it starts at 5 a.m. and it ends at 8 p.m. And is that mix? If you think you love it, you need to love it 100 times more. And then the other one is go for it. And don't listen to the people around you when they ask you when you're going to get a real job, when you're going to settle down. I've been asked all of that. Everything that you're doing is real, as long as it makes you happy. But remember, life is half a choices. You can do 50% or 50%. You can be freedom, independent, working around the world. You can have a beautiful family and a very steady job. You can do one and then the other. Sometimes if you're really lucky, you can mix a little bit the two, but you've got to pick what you want to focus on. And then once you have the 50%, if every day you feel like it's fulfilling you at 80 or 90%, then you've found your niche. So go out and experiment, go out and try.
That's great advice. So I think maybe we have time for one last question before we wrap up. Meg has a question about fear.
Hi guys. Christina, I'm so interested in obviously all of the incredible things that you do. But I wonder how, for yourself, what strategies do you have that you implement when you experience fear? Not necessarily with the sharks, as we know that you're not afraid of them and you're helping others to not be also, but when you have doubts, or if you're working with other people, if they are afraid of sharks, or if they are afraid of caves, or just as many conservationists, I think, can just be afraid to, you know, to step forward and really do what needs to be done. And I help a lot of people with that as an energy medicine practitioner and calming the nervous system, breath work, stuff like that. But I'm just really interested in your personal take on that, whether that's your personal experience or with others.
Well, that's a very, very good question, Meg. And you kind of like went from fear of sharks, fear of caves, imposter syndrome, basically what you're talking about, you know, fear or doubt of yourself. That's the imposter syndrome. In general, I acknowledge fear in people. So I never dismiss their fear. Fear is one of our two surviving instincts. Fears and disgust is what made our ancestors live. It's like, oh, disgust, I'm not going to eat that, so I'm not going to poison myself. And fear, oh, I'm really afraid of the fangs coming out of that tiger, so I'm not going to get out of my cave, otherwise I'm going to get eaten. Absolutely. So I acknowledge the fear. And in a certain way, in a jokingly way, I tell people we can sit there with the fear and for a little bit have a cup of tea and cookies. So kind of like, hey, fear, welcome, sit here with us. And then we analyze the fear and what is the fear dictated about. And then it goes back into usually knowledge and understanding. So we do welcome the fear. We do analyze the fear. Now, is this a founded fear, right? Or is this a phobia? And how do we slowly go into the phobia? Breath is very important. Knowledge, breaking down into small pieces, is the other one. That is usually for fear of sharks and caves. And then it follows with me with practical application if people come here, or hopefully sometimes with the videos. I just posted a video and they're like, I would never swim with any kind of sharks. And I'm like, really? Would you never swim with any kind of sharks, like the 6 inches lantern shark, right? Or the 45 foot whale sharks that are the filter feeders. So they bundle sharks into, you know, da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. And it's like, did you know? And so here's the knowledge, you know, there's a shark the size of a pen. Did you know there's a shark the size of a bus that actually filter feeds? Did you know that there's the nurse shark? And break it down into more edible morsels. It doesn't mean, hey, jump and come with me to Tiger Beach and be surrounded by 8 tiger sharks. Maybe we'll start with the nurse shark. That's one. The imposter syndrome, oh, my goodness, I don't know. I wish I had that answer because I suffer that every day. It's actually, in a certain way, with that one is do one step at a time. Remember, one small action is better than no big action. You don't need, Jane Goodall started somewhere somehow and then became Jane Goodall. You don't start by being Jane Goodall. And I think that's what you need to do is just do one little thing and then do the next one and establish your ground, which then includes assume the courage of empowering your own voice. That's really quick, but I hope it helps. The breathing, like you mentioned, is a big one. So before the dives, I usually go through visualization and breath control. And then during the dive, I remind my divers, hey, Exhale, relax. They actually make fun of me because I do this during the dive.
I think we'll all have to try that out too. Thank you everybody for your questions and for joining us for this recording. It's been a really great time. You may be hearing this on your favorite podcast service, watching it on our YouTube channel, or viewing it on our club's website. If the latter, we hope you'll keep scrolling down a little further to find the discussed forum section. You're welcome to leave your comments on what you think of the program and to reply to other people's comments too. One of the ways that members of our online asynchronous club collaborate and share ideas. So with that, I'd like to thank Christina for being here with us today and turn it back to her for one last word. Christina, the floor is yours again.
I would like to thank everyone for participating. I really appreciate it. I have to thank the people on the video because your visual feedback helps me a lot. Thank you so much, everyone. Remember, one small action is better than no big action.
That's a great lasting message to share. Thanks, Christina, and thank you, everyone. Until next time.